Hey everybody, Marcus here. On August 6th, the channel of Mayor of MGTOWN was taken down by YouTube. Since then, the mayor has started a new channel to continue the great work he has been doing for almost 2 years now. The mayor is a pillar of our community and is running an outreach project to help homeless men. In addition, he has done a great deal to bring attention to new channels, including my own. As such, we must take the initiative to rehydrate his subscriber count, as he had over 7,000 subs before his channel was taken down. It is important for us as a community to send a message to those who would see MGTOW brought down. We must send the message that if you take one of us down, you are wasting your time, as MGTOW will rally to bring them back up. I am linking to the mayor's new channel in the description box, and I implore you to go subscribe if you have been a subscriber before. If you have never heard of the mayor of MGTOWN before, then I encourage you to check him out, as his work is not only excellent, but his character is beyond reproach. To all content producers, I also encourage you to promote the mayor's new channel in his time of need, as tomorrow, it may be your time of need. I, for one, am honored to be in the same community as the mayor, and will do my part. My video in which I cover the topic of the wall received an overwhelmingly positive reception. However, a few of my female listeners put forward a question that could not be immediately answered from the arguments I had built up in that video. Though I am paraphrasing, the question went as follows. Marcus, your talk of deference and how it relates to the wall is all well and good, but you and all other MGTOW seem to exclusively focus on single women. How can the wall have any effect on a married woman? Does the wall affect such women too? Now, at first glance, the answer to this question, well, is quite obvious, as we had argued that neoteny is that which the wall robs women of, and neoteny is contingent on biology. It then follows that the wall would rob married women of neoteny much in the same way it would rob single women. This answer, you know, though logically sound, is not what I believe the spirit of the question was actually asking. No, I believe the true spirit of the question is much deeper and more interesting than this superficial interpretation. In light of this, let us rephrase the question to properly expose the spirit in which I believe it has been asked. The reworded question would then go as follows. Marcus, we understand that neoteny is biological and that the wall is what robs women of neoteny. However, what we do not understand is how the loss of neoteny could have any meaningful impact on a married person. After all, virtually all of the deference that you enumerate is contingent on the fact that the woman is single and directly leveraging her sexual marketplace value. But a married woman has taken herself off the market. If she is off the market, she is not engaging with the forces that a single woman does. Furthermore, if your 20-something pre-wall woman gets married at the age of 20, well, surely she has sidestepped much of the dynamic you describe, and in a non-trivial way, has also sidestepped the wall completely. So if this is the case, would it not follow that married women are in fact immune to the wall as far as the existential consequences are concerned? You know, even though they are not immune to the loss of neoteny? Now, this rephrased question is valid and relevant. You know, in attempting to answer this question, I tried a number of different angles. Each in turn seemed to fall apart under its own weight or turned into some sort of sophistry. After listening to my wall video a few times in search of clues, I stumbled upon a shortcoming in my argument. It seems like I have taken a coarse approach in a spot where more nuance was needed. In my previous video on the wall, I had asserted that women are hedonistic by nature. Further in the argument, we landed on the question of whether or not each woman experiences the wall in the same manner, or if some experience it more intensely than others. By associating the impact of the wall to the proportion of deference that an individual woman partakes in, we concluded that some women will experience the wall harder than others. More specifically, those women that choose to ride the cock carousel will experience the wall hardest, as they have partaken in the largest amount of deference. Now, though this argument logically follows, there's one other conclusion that necessarily follows as well. If indeed all women are hedonistic by nature, and the cock carousel in fact yields the highest amount of deference, and deference yields pleasure, then it would also follow that all women would choose to ride the cock carousel. However, not all women choose to ride the cock carousel. Therefore, not all women are hedonistic by nature, or there's something equivalent or greater in value to the cock carousel that maximizes pleasure and minimizes pain. Women are hedonistic by nature. Therefore, there must be something equivalent or greater in value to the cock carousel. Now, we need to identify what this thing is. To do this, we need to offer a completely new set of arguments. So, let's get started. 1. Women are hedonistic by nature. 2. Therefore, women wish to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. 3. Some instances of sex can cause pleasure, while other instances can cause pain, such as rape. 4. Therefore, women want to maximize the instances of sex that cause pleasure while minimizing the instances of sex that cause pain. 5. Therefore, women want sex, but only of a certain kind. Now, what kinds of sex can cause women pain? Well, we've already named rape as a kind of sex that causes pain, and as such, women wish to minimize that sort of sex. However, what is the nature of the pain of rape? Well, surely it can be both physical pain, emotional pain, or both. So, it would follow that sex can yield two types of pain which women would try to minimize. They would try to minimize any form of sex that would have physical pain, and they would try to minimize any sex that has emotional pain. Now, what sort of sex can cause emotional pain in addition to rape? Well, to answer this, perhaps we need to look at the sexual economy between men and women. Is it not said that men do not want to date or marry sluts? Well, surely it is said. Is it also the case that being branded a slut is painful for a woman? Well, this too is surely true, as we would not have things like slut walks if it were not. Now, if a woman's value in the sexual marketplace is contingent on her promiscuity, and being branded promiscuous causes pain, then it would follow that women would minimize on sex that would brand them as promiscuous. But surely you must be thinking to yourself, Marcus, would it not simply be easier for a woman to lie as to the number of partners she had in order to retain her value? Well, to this, I can only answer that, well, indeed it can. However, she can only lie to others. She will still know her own count, which indeed can cause her pain. I mean, to better understand this mechanism, we need only look at a guy who brags about having slept with a dozen women but is still a virgin. Now, his self-esteem and sense of self-worth is tied to the truth and not to the lie he wishes to project. So in this way, too, a woman's self-worth can, too, be tied to the truth and not the lie she would project outward. So, if we are to accept these premises, then it follows that a woman would minimize the number of partners in order to minimize her self-perception as a slut, which we have argued would cause her pain. Now, it then must follow that a woman who rides the cock carousel would surely find more pleasure by maximizing deference from multiple men, while a woman who chooses not to ride the cock carousel would associate more pain from the cock carousel due to her self-identification as a slut. So, women who ride the cock carousel either suffer no pain from being considered a slut, or substantially less than women who abstain from the cock carousel. Let us now focus on the non-carousel rider. Let us call her the good girl. The good girl, as said earlier, would avoid types of sex that would diminish her value, but actively engage in sex that does not diminish her value. Now, what sort of sexual activities would be acceptable to a good girl? Well, this would surely depend on how such a good girl would keep score. Now, the damning question that she would need to answer to herself and to others would go as follows. how many guys have you been with? Well, clearly, if she had to answer 50, then she would be branded a slut by others and by herself. But if she answered 5 and her age suggested that that count was distributed over a decade or more, then she would not be perceived as a slut by either herself or men in general. So, based on the question we have put forward, we can draw some conclusions. Firstly, masturbation, no matter how kinky, would never contribute to her count. It would also follow that, from a male perspective, any sexual activity with women would also not up her count. Thirdly, kissing any number of men would not contribute to her count. But what about giving head? Well, surely if she blew 50 guys, some damage to her image would be done, as, well, men indeed would count that as slutty behavior. However, if the inverse were true, would it be considered slutty behavior if 50 guys ate her out? You mean, I would posit that this activity would, you know, would fall into a gray area that actually leans in favor of the woman. After all, if 50 guys gave her head, she could still remain a virgin, and virgins are the antithesis of sluts. Finally, any sort of vaginal or anal penetration with the penis would surely be viewed as something that would up her count. So, it would seem that the common theme of all sexual activities that would up her count would necessitate her directly interacting with a penis. Any activities that do not seem to involve the penis in turn do not up her count, or at least float in a very gray area that could plausibly be denied as having counted. After all, a man surely would not brag about having scored if all he did was eat the girl out. So it would seem that a woman would keep count in the same way a guy would keep count. Though a guy getting a blowjob is also somewhat of a gray area as to keeping count, it surely is something men could brag about as at least a minor victory. Now, it can be argued that the aspect of sex that satisfies the most is the orgasm. As such, the most fulfilling sex is that in which an orgasm is experienced. Now, we said earlier that some types of sex cause pain, while other types cause pleasure. We also said that for a good girl, sex without qualification that increases her count would in turn be more painful than pleasurable. Then it follows that a woman would wish to maximize on sexual activity that leads to orgasm but does not increase her count. So the good girl, in theory, could retain her good girl status but still engage in the following activities with impunity: masturbation, any sexual activity with women, receiving oral, dry humping, kissing, receiving clitoral stimulation via a man's hands either directly or over clothing. Now, under this account, it follows that once a woman has had penetrative sex with a man, her count goes up. However, her count only goes up by 1 and is not contingent on a volume of or kinkiness of the sex she has engaged in with this man. Also, there is no time restriction that would ever increase her count by more than 1 for any given man. This means that she can always go back to having sex with men she has had sex with in the past without further increasing her count. You know, men such as ex-boyfriends or friends with benefits she has had in the past. A 35-year-old woman could honestly answer the question, how many guys have you been with, as 5, but lead the following lifestyle. Monday to Friday, she has sex with 1 of the 5 guys. On Saturday, she has a threesome with 2 of them. And then on Sunday, she could engage in an orgy with all 5. As 5 partners is not an extravagant number, especially for a 35-year-old, she could hardly be called promiscuous. After all, if she started having sex at the age of 15, then she only introduced 1 new partner every 4 years. Well, that frequency hardly describes a slut. Now, if a woman is to increase her count by having penetrative sex with a new partner, she would feel like she is indeed trading something of value. After all, she has already figured out ways of achieving orgasm with a male partner without the need to up her count. As such, our good girl will want something in return. Now, there are 2 types of things she could possibly desire in return. Firstly, she may want something non-temporal and tangible, some immediate return that is within the power of the man to grant at that point in time or in the immediate future. This could be as trivial as, you know, a pair of shoes, to something more involved like a promotion at work. Once the exchange is complete, the deal has been fulfilled. In the second case, she may want something temporal and non-tangible in exchange. She may want the status of girlfriend or wife, you know, something that only comes from an ongoing association. In the first case, if she wants something non-temporal and tangible, then she is maximizing deference in the way the carousel rider does. As such, the good girl cannot possibly be after a non-temporal and tangible exchange. It then follows that the good girl will up her count for something temporal and non-tangible. However, all temporal articles of exchange require the man's commitment as the exchange is ongoing. Therefore, the good girl is exchanging sex for commitment. From this, it would follow that the good girl would practice serial monogamy. Now, any volume of sex in a monogamous relationship is outside the scope of upping a woman's count and therefore coheres with the type of sex that yields pleasure for a good girl. But why would a woman up her count in exchange for commitment? Well, she surely must see it as something valuable. So how does a woman come to see commitment from a man as valuable? 1. There are fewer desirable men than undesirable men. 2. Women pursue desirable men. 3. Therefore, desirable men are pursued by many women. Now, if desirable men have many women to choose from, then it follows that they can choose those women who do not demand commitment for sex. As such, desirable men are disinclined to commit in exchange for sex. If few desirable men commit in exchange for sex and women pursue desirable men, then it follows that women will find commitment from men as hard to come by. Those things which are hard to come by are valuable. Therefore, women will find commitment from men as valuable. So, as women need to up their count after having penetrative sex with a new partner, and upping their count diminishes their value, they see penetrative sex offered by them as valuable. As it has also been argued that women see commitment from men as valuable, then it follows that women will see commitment from men to be a fair exchange for sex. There is one more argument I want to put forward in relation to commitment that I think will help us understand the good girl better. This is going to seem a little disjoint, but is necessary for me to go through, or you might not readily accept the conclusion, which I think is very interesting. 1. Women want resources. 2. Commitment from men yields resources. 3. Therefore, women want commitment from men. Next argument. Women compete with other women. 2. A man can only commit to one woman at a time in modern culture. 3. Women compete for male commitment. 4. Therefore, getting commitment from a man is a woman winning against other women. Next argument. 1. There is a hierarchy among women. 2. Winning puts you higher in the hierarchy. 3. Getting a man to commit is winning. 4. Therefore, a woman rises higher in the hierarchy by getting commitment from men. And the final argument. 1. Commitment from desirable men is rare. 2. Getting something rare gives you a high. 3. Women chase commitment. 4. Therefore, commitment gives them a high. So, from what we have argued, it would appear that women chasing commitment from men can be analogized to men chasing women for sex. Women get a high from securing commitment from a man. Next, let us take our argument further on how a good girl would maximize on pleasurable sex and minimize on painful sex. To do this, we need to look at the concept of sexual satisfaction and how a woman can achieve it. 1. Women are multi-orgasmic. 2. Men are uni-orgasmic. 3. Therefore, male sexual satisfaction is absolute, while female sexual satisfaction is on a spectrum. From this, it follows that a woman who achieves orgasm is not necessarily sexually satisfied. Therefore, bringing a woman to orgasm is not equivalent to sexually satisfying a woman. Now, if women are multi-orgasmic, and we posit that only one orgasm can take place at a time, then it follows that it takes more time for a woman to achieve multiple orgasms than it does for her to achieve one orgasm. Now, let us posit that women have a sexual threshold, and that when this threshold is reached, any subsequent orgasm is painful and not pleasurable. From this, it follows that a woman must necessarily be sexually satisfied when she reaches this threshold, as anything exceeding this threshold would be painful. So, for men and women to both reach sexual satisfaction, the man would need to orgasm at the same point that the woman has reached her threshold. If a man does not have the stamina to maintain sexual activity until the woman reaches her threshold, he will leave the woman unsatisfied or only partially satisfied. Now, if a man orgasms before she reaches her threshold but still wants her to reach sexual satisfaction, he will need to exert effort through either manual or oral stimulation or both. With the man sexually satisfied, all such manual or oral effort on his part he will experience as work. Now, if a man has the stamina to last beyond the threshold of the woman, then it follows that any additional sexual stimulation of the woman will cause her pain. As such, either the woman leaves the man unsatisfied sexually, or she exerts effort to either manually or orally complete the process. As the woman is already sexually satisfied, any effort she needs to exert either manually or orally, she will experience as work. Next, men can usually achieve orgasm before women have reached their threshold. From this, it follows that it will be men who will usually need to exert manual work to sexually fulfill the woman or retain intense focus in preventing from orgasming. Now, retaining intense focus in preventing an orgasm on the part of the man is also work. Therefore, it follows that men will usually be the ones exerting work to sexually satisfy a woman. But work is not fun. Therefore, bringing a woman to sexual satisfaction is not fun, logically. Of course, this should not be construed as implying that sex with women is not fun, only that the labor a man must exert after he is satisfied is not fun. As bringing a woman to sexual satisfaction is no fun for men, and prolonged repetition of activities that are not fun are typically something people minimize, then it follows that men will minimize bringing women to sexual satisfaction. Now, this is not really that big of a surprise. I mean, men tend to conflate giving a woman an orgasm with her sexual satisfaction. I would posit that men often, who have brought a woman to orgasm, use this as an indicator that they are free to orgasm themselves at any point immediately thereafter because their job is done. Unfortunately, from our argument, this seems to be flawed thinking. So, what happens due to this flawed thinking? Well, it can be said that no sex is better than unsatisfying sex. As men tend to minimize the work they exert, so too they will minimize the number of instances in which a woman will be sexually satisfied. With all of this said, it eventually becomes the case that a woman will prefer no sex with such a man rather than the minimum effort he is willing to put in, which only leads to sexual dissatisfaction. Okay. After a person reaches sexual satisfaction, a recuperative period will follow. The desire for sex will then emerge once again immediately following this recuperative period. Now, if every sexual encounter is satisfying, then the frequency of sex is governed by the recuperative period. If a man reaches sexual satisfaction and a woman does not reach sexual satisfaction, she feels as if she has gotten a bad deal. And bad deals, of course, discourage future transactions. If a woman does not achieve sexual satisfaction consistently, she will minimize the number of transactions. Now, wives and girlfriends can feel an obligation to have sex with a man. Therefore, such a wife or girlfriend would feel obligated to continue participating in a bad deal. However, resentment grows from obligation to participation in a bad deal. So it follows that women resent men that do not sexually satisfy them. Also, if every sexual encounter is unsatisfying, then the frequency approaches zero, as it has been argued that women will minimize sex that they deem painful. Since unsatisfied sex is work, and work is pain, women minimize sex. You know, often when you hear women complain about sex, they describe feeling used, you know, like masturbation tools. This sort of existential experience immediately becomes intelligible under this account. We said earlier that bringing a woman to orgasm is not equivalent to sexual satisfaction. We had also argued that men often associate bringing her to orgasm as the completion of his work. So if these two things hold true, then it is quite possible that a woman who is consistently brought to orgasm is still consistently left sexually unsatisfied. If this is the case, then she may reach orgasm and still feel she was only a masturbation tool because the sexual activity ended before she reached her threshold. Now, before we move on, I would like to tackle criticisms of this argument before they are even raised. You might be thinking to yourself, but Marcus, not all women are multi-orgasmic, and some men last longer than others, while some women can achieve orgasm really quickly. And I agree with these observations. However, none of these criticisms matter, because I do not assume static natures of men and women's sexual drives. In fact, I assume variability. It is only under variability that this account makes sense. If sex drives were assumed to be static, then it would follow that there is only one ideal pairing, one in which the man's stamina corresponds directly to a woman's threshold. As human sex drives change throughout people's lives, we inevitably introduce variability. If variability is introduced, then my arguments become relevant. It also becomes likely that the dynamic we argued for plays itself out. So far, a majority of what has been argued for was focused on the mechanics from a hedonistic approach on how women would minimize sex they deem painful. Of course, minimization of sex, of painful sex, is not exclusively the domain of women. As crazy as it can seem at face value, men too minimize sex. This can easily be observed under two scenarios. Under the first scenario, the woman has a sex drive far surpassing that of a man. For such a man, the prospect of sex entails that every session will demand a great deal of work, as he will need to work past his orgasm towards her satisfaction. If a man can only last for, say, 30 minutes, but it takes the woman 45 to achieve an orgasm and 2 hours to achieve satisfaction, this man will, on average, exert 15 minutes of work to get her off, or 1.5 hours to satisfy her. Alternatively, he may elect to perform 1.5 hours of various foreplay and reserve the last 30 minutes to match up with her threshold. In either case, he's putting out 1.5 hours of work. Yeah, though this might be something he would be willing to do a few times, he will begin to find that the tedium grossly outweighs the benefit and avoid sex altogether. Or alternatively, only meet his own satisfaction, and in turn, the woman would avoid sex. The second scenario is one in which the woman is hyperorgasmic. This woman would achieve satisfaction quickly, then either stop all sexual activity or do a half-assed job of finishing him off. And from the existential experience of a woman, this second scenario is kind of equivalent to a man just rolling over and going to sleep right after getting off. Now, I want to venture on a somewhat speculative argument, as I have not fully researched the topic I'm about to talk about. However, I believe it has merit to it. To those who would attack the premises that follow, please keep in mind that this is a side argument and not necessary to the overarching goal of this video. Okay. An orgasm acts on the central nervous system of the person experiencing it. I posit that the intensity with which the central nervous system is overloaded during orgasm corresponds to the time it takes for someone to desire sex again after orgasm. This means that if you have an intense orgasm, it will take your nervous system longer to recover, and therefore you will not crave sex for a longer period of time than if you had a mild orgasm. Now, if women are multi-orgasmic, their nervous system will be overloaded to a much higher intensity when they reach their threshold than the overload that occurs in a man who only has a single orgasm. Though, you know, it may be said that the male orgasm may be more intense than a female orgasm, the succession of female orgasms, I would argue, leads to her threshold will, as a sum, be more intense than a single male orgasm. If these premises hold true, then it would follow that men would want sex more often, but for shorter durations, while women would want sex less frequently, but for longer durations. So, where a man might want 30 minutes of sex every other day, the woman might want a single two-hour session once a week. Okay, we covered a great deal of ground in our discussion of maximizing and minimizing sex, so let us sum everything up and return to the core question we initially set out to answer, and that question being, does the wall affect married women? So far, we have argued the distinction between the carousel rider and the good girl. The carousel rider maximizes deference and experiences little or no emotional pain from the notion of being a slut. The good girl, on the other hand, experiences more pain from the notion of being a slut than the perceived pleasure she would gain from maximizing deference by sleeping with many men. We also argued that the good girl would minimize the number of partners she has penetrative sex with, in an unqualified sense, in order to maximize her value. We then proceeded to argue that the good girl would trade an increase in her count for temporal, non-tangible benefits, which we concluded was commitment from a man. We also argued that chasing commitment gives women a high similar to that which a man experiences from chasing sex. Finally, we took the massive detour into accounting for sexual satisfaction and the consequences that variable sex drives can have on the activity of minimizing and maximizing sexual activity. Okay, if the good girl trades sex for commitment and she values sex from her at A, then she will only trade it for commitment valued at A or above. So, how will a woman determine the value of any particular man's commitment? Well, here we are back on theoretically familiar ground and can freely refer to Brifold's law. Brifold's law being, the female and not the male dictate all conditions of the animal family. Where the female can derive no benefit from association with the male, no such association will take place. So, it would follow that the value of a man's commitment is contingent on the value of the benefit he can provide. Now, let us imagine that our good girl finds a man who is willing to commit in exchange for sex and whose commitment she deems adequately valuable. Now, our good girl has a boyfriend. Okay. Now, most relationships have a certain progression as to the nature of the activities that take place. In the very early stages, the two will, you know, go to the movies, to dinner, take bike rides, hang out at each other's houses, you know, and so forth. These early stage activities have a relatively small financial footprint. However, as the relationship stretches from weeks to months, is it not the case that the financial footprint of the activities engaged in also increases? Well, surely it does. I mean, weekend getaways, vacations, elaborate gifts such as jewelry, iPhones, you know, and so forth. You know, these begin to be introduced into the relationship. There is a natural increase in benefit that the woman gains as the relationship progresses. This is the return on her initial investment of upping her count. However, these benefits have a natural termination point, a plateau, as it were. The man will eventually reach a financial limit after which, well, he cannot afford to introduce any new pleasures into the life of the woman. After all, once he has already bought into, you know, giving birthday gifts, Christmas gifts, and Valentine's Day gifts, going on vacations with her to the upper limit of days that his job will allow, I mean, there is no more he can offer after that. Now, for a carousel rider, this plateau is the absolute limit that can be reached with a single man. The carousel rider would then maximize her pleasure by maximizing deference with a second man, then a third, and so forth. However, this option is not available to the good girl. Once the good girl has reached this plateau of her man, she will see her investment stop growing. However, she wishes to continue in maximizing her pleasure. If finding a second man to subsidize her desires is not an option, and her boyfriend has reached his economical limit, she will look towards minimizing costs. Now, how can she minimize costs if she is both spending all her money and he has no more money to spend on her? Cohabitation. She will propose cohabitation. By minimizing the cost of rent and utilities, she will free up more income within the relationship in order for her to further increase her pleasure. Cohabitation has the double benefit of minimizing cost and the high the woman will receive from securing more commitment from the man. But again, once the benefit that emerges from this becomes familiar, another plateau is reached. And once this happens, the last level of maximizing her pleasure is to pursue marriage, the ultimate high of commitment. Now, marriage carries with it, you know, the wedding gifts, and a day of undivided attention and praise. There's also the anticipation of the wedding itself, which is also pleasurable. The wedding and honeymoon is the last plateau that the good girl can reach. She now legally owns the man, you know, for all practical purposes. We are now at a point where our pre-wall 20-something good girl has secured a man who she eventually married. Now, it is important to remember that this process undoubtedly has brought our 20-something-year-old close to her mid-20s. She would spend a few years to sift through men who would, commit in exchange for sex, of which most turned out to be duds. And then, finally, one stuck. The one that stuck would have been a boyfriend for a year or two. Then they cohabitated for a year or two. And finally, our good girl and her hapless blue pillar got hitched. All of this happened without our good girl riding the cock carousel. Now, whether or not the details of the transition from singlehood to wife are accurate or, reflective of any majority of women is not overly important. I mean, after all, we are trying to see if the wall affects married women. So it follows that the woman we are looking at did go through some process to get married, which did not involve the cock carousel. So our good girl is now married. Now, many men report that sex stopped when they got married. I posit that the reason for the sex stopping was due to the dynamic of minimizing sex that causes pain, as I previously argued. I mean, after all, if the sex was satisfying, it would not follow that a woman would stop having sex. Though it is not the case that all instances of marriage bring into being the immediate cessation of sex, it is almost universally reported that the frequency of sex gradually degrades over the course of a long-term relationship. I mean, though this can be attributed to the decreasing sex drives that come with age, this explanation would only account for postmenopausal women and, men in their 50s and 60s. I mean, age is a poor account for the sexless marriages that exist of people in their 20s, 30s, or for that matter, even couples in their 40s. Now, when our good girl got married in her mid-20s, she would have been with her man for 4 or 5 years by then. Now, let us extend her relationship now to her late 20s or early 30s. By this point, she has hit the wall. Okay, let us start a new inductive argument. 1. The average age of divorce is 30. 2. Women initiate 70% of all divorces. 3. The most common reason women cite for divorce is dissatisfaction. 4. Therefore, women around 30 are most likely to be dissatisfied with their marriages and initiate a divorce. I mean, this is not a radical argument. The only interesting and nebulous aspect of this argument is what the meaning of dissatisfaction is. Now, for the rest of the video, I will argue that this dissatisfaction is the consequence that married women experience due to the wall. where the carousel rider was argued to succumb to a decrease in her quality of life due to the gradual withdrawal of deference on the part of the men, the married good girl experiences a slightly different set of consequences, but still due to the wall. The difference can be seen as an internal-external dichotomy, where the carousel rider suffers pain due to the changes in behavior of those external to her. The good girl suffers an existential crisis due to a shift in internal forces that she then externalizes. So, to be more concise, the carousel rider's environment changes, which triggers her crisis, whereas the good girl's internal state changes that repaints her environment to seem bad. Okay, the good girl is married. Therefore, she has reached the maximum level of commitment she can get from a man. From this, it follows that there's nothing she can look forward to on this front. As we have argued previously that women get a high from chasing commitment, our good girl has now been deprived of any future possibility of this high. The good girl has maximized the benefit she can derive from her husband, as he has natural limits in terms of time and earning potential, so there's nothing more that can be maximized there either. Finally, she has minimized all costs. From this, it follows that her external circumstances have reached an equilibrium. Only monotonous sameness can be expected. As far as sex is concerned, it is almost certain that the minimization of sex that causes pain has been achieved. As variability is virtually certain between two people over a long period of time, it is almost certain that an interplay of minimizing sex on the part of both the woman and the man has led to a sexless marriage, or one in which sex is done out of obligation, as we have argued that sex out of obligation leads to resentment. It is the case that if sex is taking place, then one party resents the other for it. As it has also been argued that men usually orgasm first, and men typically mistake bringing a woman to orgasm as satisfying a woman, it would follow that it usually is the woman who will resent the man over an obligation for sex. Therefore, in both cases, where the marriage is sexless and where the sex is done out of obligation, no sexual satisfaction is achieved on the part of the woman. Now, in the previous video, we had argued that the loss of neoteny was due to testosterone playing a more prominent role in the body chemistry of the woman. We also argued that it was not only the physical traits of the woman that would be altered, but also her behavioral qualities. One of the behavioral qualities that comes with increased testosterone would be a heightened sex drive. So, now we have a woman who has a heightened sex drive in either a sexless marriage or having sex out of an obligation with a man who seemingly cannot satisfy her sexually. Now, I am not arguing that sexlessness or sameness is the cause of the dissatisfaction women cite. Not at all. These are merely results of maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. So, what is the dissatisfaction women refer to? Well, perhaps we need to look at how desire works. Can desires be fulfilled? Well, surely they can. Can a desire be both fulfilled and unfulfilled at the same time? Well, surely not. Is it not the case that to desire something is to long to acquire the object of desire? This too is true. So, when one acquires the object of desire, it can be said that this desire is fulfilled. As a desire cannot be fulfilled and unfulfilled at the same time, it must then be the case that one no longer desires the object of desire. For if one still desired the object that one has acquired, then one would both have their desire fulfilled and unfulfilled at the same time, which we've argued is impossible. From this it follows that one can only desire that which one does not have. So, if we follow this argument, we can ask ourselves, does our married good girl desire her husband? It would follow that she cannot desire him. Now, it is important not to conflate a desire for future benefit derived from having a husband with the desire for the husband himself. The benefit can be desired as it has not yet been fulfilled, but the desire of the husband has been fulfilled. So it follows that a married woman can only have desire for any man except her husband. Now, I posit that people conflate the desire of future benefit with desire for the person, and through this fallacious thinking, believe they actually desire the person. So in this way, a wife can say that she still desires her husband, but implicitly means the future benefit derived from his existence. But perhaps this is too radical of an argument to be accepted without further exposition. What do we mean when we say desire of a future benefit? For example, I may desire a degree in engineering, but once I receive it, I cannot desire the degree any longer. Now, I can only desire the benefit of the degree. However, can the degree ever be lost? Well, surely not. So, though I may desire roles that demand an engineering degree, I no longer desire the degree itself, nor fear losing it, and therefore losing the possible future benefits. But this is clearly different with a husband who a wife may lose, and with him the possibility of future benefits. So, there must be two kinds of things we desire: those that cannot be lost once obtained, and those that can be lost after being obtained. Those that cannot be lost guarantee future benefit. Now, when we cannot lose something, do we any longer engage in behavior to maintain our possession of it? Well, surely not, as no such behavior is necessary. I mean, we feel entitled to such things. But what about those objects of our desire that once obtained could be lost? Well, we may fear losing them. But then, are we compelled by desire or by fear? Well, we can only desire that which we do not have. We cannot fear losing that which we do not have, for we do not have it. So it follows that we can only fear losing that which we already have. From this, it follows that a woman can only desire future benefit and never fear losing it. It also follows that a woman can only ever fear losing her husband and never keep him out of desire. As future benefit is contingent on the man, and she can only fear losing the man, then it follows that she is compelled by fear, if at all. But if a woman desires the future benefit from association with a man, but does not fear losing the man, then she necessarily must consider herself entitled to the man. Such a woman would, like with our degree example, do nothing to maintain the future benefit, for she does not see her husband as something that can be lost. Men desire sex, and like women, minimize on the amount of painful sex. So, if a man minimizes the amount of painful sex, and this does not align with the threshold of the woman, then he in fact is not sexually satisfying the woman. If a woman in turn minimizes on sex in the same way, a sexless marriage occurs. However, if she does this, knowing that the man desires sex, then it must follow that she does not fear losing the man due to a lack of sex, for if she did, she would maintain the unsatisfying sex life out of a fear of losing her husband and therefore foregoing on future benefit. So, in a sexless marriage, it must follow that the wife feels entitled to the man at least to the extent to which she feels no fear in losing him due to the lack of sex. As it is typically reported, you know, that women fear their men having emotional affairs due to the potential withdrawal of resources, she must then necessarily not fear him having an emotional affair due to the lack of sex in the marriage. So, in this way, the woman feels entitled to emotional fidelity. But like it has been said earlier, women are hedonistic by nature, and sex that causes pleasure is something that women want. So sex becomes the last area that a woman has not yet maximized pleasure in the marriage. If the testosterone boost from the wall increases her sex drive, and she has already deemed her husband unable to sexually satisfy her, and she has no desire for her husband, then it follows that she is vulnerable to get the vaginal tingles from another man. In addition, testosterone has the effect of enhancing risk-taking behaviors. But how does it do this? Well, surely by minimizing the fear associated with the behavior. So it would follow that an increase in testosterone would dampen a woman's sense of fear compared to her pre-wall experience. From this, we can then infer that her sense of fear of losing her husband would also be dampened. Now, let us imagine what happens if a man who she deems desirable shows interest in her and she gets those vaginal tingles. She experiences desire for this new man. The monotony of sameness is broken with a feeling she no longer remembers having for her husband. Did she ever have this feeling for her husband? Well, perhaps she never did, because now her body chemistry is altered in a way that was not the case when she first met her husband. It is also important to remember that our married good girl never rode the cock carousel, so doubts may enter her mind as to her decision in choosing her husband. The idea that she chose the wrong man must haunt her. Now, this experience does not make her cheat, however. It merely seeds doubt in her mind. This doubt fuels her reevaluation of her current marriage. She is thrown into an emotional crisis that is in no way curtailed by any fear of losing her husband, as argued before. Now, these thoughts germinate into a longing for this new man. Now, if she succumbs to an affair, her resolve is strengthened. This new man, it seems to her, is substantially better in bed than her husband. This, however, well, is only the case as the minimization of painful sex has not begun with this new partner. He is eager to please and will put in the work willingly to reach her threshold. Oh, and this would account, along with the effect of novelty, in why sex is always best at the start of a relationship. Both are putting in the effort. Now, the entire process, from getting those first vaginal tingles to leading up to an affair, can span months. Now, during this time, she is unaware that she is slowly withdrawing from her dependence on the emotional support of her husband. This process carries on long into the affair, until the point where she is no longer in any way emotionally dependent on her husband. Everything seems better with this new man. I mean, none of the day-to-day drudgery is present, as they neither live together, nor is there a history of baggage. But in all this time, she feels guilty. Guilty that she is no longer the good girl she saw herself as. But she is no longer the good girl only in the eyes of her husband. At least, that's what she believes. She will reiterate her guilt to the new partner, you know, to make herself seem like a good girl in the eyes of her lover. Her guilt inevitably leads her towards a desire to leave her husband. She tells him she is dissatisfied. Also, by leaving her husband, she would reset the history of bad deeds. And this reset allows her to retain a self-image of the good girl. In order to erase her past of misdeeds, she must free herself of witnesses of those misdeeds, namely her husband. And this is the dissatisfaction women cite that we have been looking for. She is dissatisfied because she does not feel the desire for her husband that she feels for her lover. Additionally, her self-image is forever tainted in her marriage. But she won't just up and leave her husband, no. She does not want him to feel bad. I mean, she does all she can to help him leave her. But why would she not just break up with him? This, I believe, is a twofold answer. I mean, firstly, she believes that it will be less painful for her husband if he decides to leave her. And secondly, there's less chance of a violent outburst if he decides to leave her. But does this man leave? No. He does everything in his power to try and please the wife. He becomes more attentive and considerate. I mean, he'll try and meet all the expectations that she attributes to her dissatisfaction. If she complains about him not doing housework, well, he will start doing all the housework. If she complains over any hobby he has, he will immediately eliminate it. And he will do as such for each item on her list, which perpetually grows. However, this makes her angry instead. I mean, this greatly confuses her husband, this anger. I mean, how can she be angry when he is doing everything to fix the problems? Well, she is furious for the very reason that he is trying to fix the problems instead of just breaking up with her, which is the only thing he can actually do to please her. She may suggest couples counseling, but this is only for show. I mean, it is there to demonstrate there's really no hope. Also, she may pursue couples counseling for selfish reasons. I mean, she may want to justify to herself that she tried everything to save her marriage. However, none of this is meant to work. She has already checked out. She checked out most likely months or even years prior. She checked out when she first met this new man. Finally, she will say that she needs a trial separation to either, you know, find herself or figure stuff out. But why does she need her own apartment for this purpose? I mean, you don't need your own apartment to figure out if you want to be a doctor or a dentist. You don't need your own apartment to figure out if you like golf or baseball. No. You only need your own apartment to fuck other men without having to exert effort in concealing your own comings and goings. Finally, if the husband has not left her by that point, she will decide for him. On a side note, you know, Stardust talks of a concept he refers to as the ejection switch. You know, a moment when a woman comes home one day and out of the blue breaks up with the man for no apparent reason. This ejection switch is no more than a woman who checked out months or years prior and has simply been detaching herself emotionally until she could leave without emotional fallout for herself. I mean, it is a surprise to a man, but nothing more than the conclusion to a long grieving period the woman experienced in secret. At least, you know, under this account, that is what the ejection switch is. So, there we have it. This is how the wall affects married women. You know, though the last sections was less of an argument and more of a series of assertions, I would like to point out where the argument ended. For a married woman, the wall brings about the vulnerability in women to succumbing to the allure of a new lover. This is done through increasing a woman's sex drive and numbing her fear in losing her husband. In turn, this brings about risk-taking behavior. You know, couple this with the monotony of marriage, the lack of anything to look forward to, the very likely case of a sexless marriage, and the re-triggered thrill of chasing commitment, and we can see why the average age of divorce is 30. So no, getting married young does not save women from the wall. Thanks for listening. Go team.